say good morning to Stephen Brent. Hey, okay, how about those Stampeders, Stephen? The 101 points against Ontario. How about that?
Yeah.
5 days.
They're really good. Somebody's really bad. So where would you, you know, I'm not sure quite where to come down on this. Like, the East is dreadful, isn't it? And the Argonauts are probably the best team in the East. And they were pretty thoroughly clobbered last night in front of family and friends, by the way, at BMO Field. I guess you guys saw the attendance number there last night.
Yeah, 11,616. And I believe with the Stamps going into a bye, at least a third of that would have been people wearing red. Also, the empty seats were red. It kind of felt like McMahon Stadium in a way, if you just squinted.
You just pretended the empty seats were human?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you could do that. Well, I also pointed out there was nothing else going on sports-wise last night in Toronto. They had the world to themselves. They had an absolute blank slate there, and it was looked like a reasonably nice evening in Toronto. So, you know, we've talked about this a fair bit, but that kind of tells you where they are, where the poor old Argonauts are. You know, again, playing a 500 team, which in the East is a powerhouse going into that game, and nothing else on their plate on a beautiful sunny night in an outdoor stadium, and no one shows up. So
crickets.
That's bad.
It's horrible. And here's the thing. I never seem to miss a swing at the CFL for things that I think are very easily corrected and stupid. They've actually had a good week. They corrected what was clearly a twisting of what they were trying to accomplish in instant replay. They've got it back to where it probably should be. Kudos to the new commissioner. But I didn't realize that there was a major turf issue at BMO as well. This was insane that at the 2-inch line, it goes from actual grass to putting carpet. And
yeah,
it seemed to almost cost Ricky Ray a groin.
Factored into the game 3 or 4 times as well.
Yeah, just brutal.
And it was interesting. I was listening to the broadcast, and, you know, Dwayne Ford, who was doing the color last night, made the, you know, completely reasonable suggestion, why don't they just make it all grass?
Yeah.
Which seemed to me like a reasonable suggestion. Now, he was kind of slapped down for having made that suggestion, but, you know, you have to have a grass field there for the soccer team. That's part of the deal. And they are kind of the primary tenants in there. Which rankles some people, but that's just the truth of it. So why would you not go all grass rather than that little bit of field turf, you know, at a rather vital place in the field, right? So if a guy's dropping back to throw a pass in his own end zone or dropping back to punt in his own end zone, a lot of weird stuff happens. You know, and eventually you assume someone will get hurt too. So
yes.
Yeah, that was totally bizarre. But, you know, to flip back to the commissioner for just a second, because I I love the league, but I spent most of my life talking about stupid things the league has done, because that's, God love our CFL, but that's it. And some really terrible commissioners, you know, some of the worst kind of leadership in the history of sport. But that, simple gesture of saying our replay rule is not doing what it was intended to do, it is being manipulated, it's making the games worse, not better, so we're going to change it, you know, right in the, you know, mid-race, I thought that may be the most kind of bold and smart thing I've ever seen a CFL commissioner do in my lifetime.
Yes, it's true. And it's so minor,
right?
But it's actually, it's actually logical.
They would say, we'll wait till the end of the season. We're going to study this. We're going to, you know, get our rules committee to have a look at it. We'll talk to the general managers. Instead, he just stood up and said, you know, this is really stupid.
Yeah.
And no one thinks it's a good idea, so let's change it right now.
It is absolutely incredibly logical and something you wouldn't expect of a CFL commissioner. And I thought you were your only chance at someone that knew what to do with the job.
I think they may have the right guy here.
Yeah.
You know, early returns are really good. Now, you know, again, some of the problems like the one we were just talking about are beyond the powers of any human being. So, you know, he'd have to be, he'd have to be godlike in order to fix what's going on in Toronto, but fix the stuff that you can fix, you know, fix the stuff that is within your powers. And you know, that was a great first step that I know we would not have seen from, well, we certainly wouldn't have seen it from Jeffrey Orridge, because I don't think he knew anything about football or about the game or about the CFL, which is, you know, you would think would be prerequisites for that job. But, you know, even guys like Mark Cohan, you know, it takes a degree of confidence about, you know, not just being the marketing guy, but being a guy who understands the game and the sport and the way the league works without, you know, really. You know, that has been pretty much absent from guys running this league. So, you know, you've got a unique combination of things with the new guy, and because he played the game, and I think there's one where you see him step in and say, no, I can make a football decision here that will make our product better. So, yeah, hats off, and I it's I didn't know that I would live long enough to see something like that happen.
So what about these Stampeders? They have beaten Ottawa. They have beaten Hamilton. They have beaten Toronto. They have beaten Saskatchewan. They have beaten Winnipeg. I don't know how good they are. They look very, very good, but yet no BC, no Edmonton yet. And until you do, it's kind of tough to compare.
Yeah, they have a weird loss to Montreal, right?
That's, yes, on the road.
We'll call that the asterisk loss because I'm not sure. I don't think Montreal is very good. Let's put it this way. We are now in August, I believe. Do you think it is possible that any team other than Calgary, BC, or Edmonton will win the Grey Cup?
No.
No.
No, okay, it's football, so, and injuries happen, because I like Dargos with Ricky Ray more than I do with Cody Fajita or whatever the guy's name is. But
Yeah, but they're not going to win the Grey Cup. That, like, they could fluke their way into the Grey Cup through the East, and, you know, funny things can happen in a one game. You know, it's happened, right? Like, weird teams have won Grey Cups that, you know, had crappy records during the regular season.
Even right Ottawa now, last year, right? It sounded like the West Division final was supposed to be the Grey Cup last year.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, funny things happen in one game. And so that could happen, I guess. And again, I think the most likely team in the East to be able to do that would be Toronto if Ricky Ray is healthy. Although, you know, the fact he got banged on that same shoulder again, and he looked pretty unhappy last night. So I have a hard time thinking here. And he's also been taking a pounding this year. So whether he goes out after this game or he gets knocked out after another game, you know, he can't let Ricky Ray take that kind of a beating. We know what happens. So I'm going to say they're not going to win. So it's a three-team tournament in the first week of August, which is not a great thing for the league, by the way. But I just think those teams are head and shoulders above everyone else. And, you know, the Western Final will be the Grey Cup. You're right. We said that last year, and we were all wrong. Mm-hmm. But I just don't. I have a hard time believing otherwise. So yeah, that they will have to at some point. They will have to beat at least one of those two teams, and probably both of them, to get to the Grey Cup.
Here is the silver lining for the CFL. If the Saskatchewan Roughriders are still in for the crossover, it's going to be an immensely profitable season.
Yeah, it will. It'll be profitable for Saskatchewan for sure. It's funny, though. Again, we've talked about this a bit. That there, the malaise in the television numbers this year. I'm not sure what's going on there because I don't really have an explanation for that. But, you know, their TV ratings are down 15%, and across the board. And you don't. I'm not seeing the Saskatchewan spike that we used to say, where if the Riders were in a game, you would see, you know, suddenly the 500,000 went to 800,000 on television. Hmm. That doesn't seem to be happening right now. So yeah, obviously in that stadium, they're making buckets of money, and they will continue to make buckets of money. And I'm sure they're selling all kinds of their branded stuff and all of those things, but they don't seem to be lifting the rest of the league the way they have in the past. And I don't know why. And again, obviously if they're better and they're in playoff contention, yeah, I guess people will be increasing. Well, can they care more in Saskatchewan than they do now? I'm not sure.
No.
But it's just, again, there's some funny numbers this year that it just kind of feels like the whole thing's a bit stale, for Canadians and, kind of speaking for the whole country. And I'm just looking at the numbers across the board that people, and maybe even in Saskatchewan, look, they've got a great, the stadium's obviously fantastic, and Lord knows the kind of passion and the intense interest on the kind of microscopic doings of that franchise are like nowhere else in Canada. You can have debates about bench players and offensive line coaches and everything in Regina that you just can't do anywhere else in Canada. But the bloom's off the rose a little bit this year, and I don't know why.
Ditto for the Blue Jays. Interestingly, I think the caliber of CFL football, just as an aside, has been really good this year. The games have been phenomenal.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
Too bad the numbers haven't reflected that, I suppose. Too bad for someone else, not for us. As for the Blue Jays, I'm sure ratings will start to dwindle here. They're 5.5 out, which seems crazy. It's not a lot, but still 6 games under. What to watch here in the next month? I mean, obviously we have the waiver trade deadline at the end of August, but what are you looking for when you tune into a game?
Well, I think you're going to be looking at guys, you're going to be watching Marco Estrada to see if he starts, he kind of builds on what he's done recently and starts to look like the old Marco Estrada, which will influence, there's a lot of talk now about the Jays going out and looking to extend him, to bring him back for another couple of seasons, which I think wouldn't be the worst decision in the world. So you're going to watch that. You're going to watch maybe Devin Travis come back this month and see if he can stay healthy. That's going to have a huge impact on what they do going forward, you know, whether they can count on him at second base. And again, I know organizationally there's a bit of skepticism there about whether he's ever going to be healthy enough to play a full season. So that's a tricky one. Aaron Sanchez may be coming back from the blister. Can they build him back up? Does he throw again? Do you see him again this year? Or at some point do they just shut him down and say, we'll see you in 2018? And then I think you're going to see some interesting call-ups. So, you know, I think Lourdes Gurriel will be called up in September, if not before. I think Anthony Alford, who's having to come back from injury and is looking really good at AA, you might see him. You know, because, you know, one of the interesting discussions around this team is going to be, you know, who plays the corner outfield spots next year? Or maybe even who plays center field? Like, I don't think it's a given that Kevin Pillar will be back next year. Obviously, you know, they have him under contract, but if they have somebody else who can play that position, maybe Teo Hernandez, the guy they got from Houston, you know, who has played center, you could have a very different looking outfield, you know, in terms of its age and its athleticism than you've had this year. I think you have to have that. So that's the kind of stuff. And you know, the other thing is, and again, I don't want to go down the road because it's crazy, but you know, if they win 7 or 8 games in a row somehow, then everybody's going to start watching the scoreboard again and watching the standings again.
Yep.
You know, they're not going to get back in it, but it could feel like they're back in it. You know, like the same thing that just happened with the Orioles where they won a bunch of games. They suddenly, you look at it and say, hang on a second, we're only 2.5 games out. You know, that's the beauty of the second wild card. So, you know, it is not inconceivable that they could run off some wins, although, you know, they've just come through the most forgiving part of their schedule, and it's going to get a whole lot harder starting with Houston tonight.
Yeah, then the Yankees, who have loaded up big time. Give us a little more backstory on Anthony Alford, because he's a guy that at the time they took him, it wasn't a sure thing he'd be a baseball player, and is a guy that I think will get a lot of run in September, because I would think if he's healthy, he's coming up when rosters expand, if not sooner.
Yeah, well, exactly. And here, you know, he's already been up this year. He's already made his debut, and then he broke the hamate bone in his hand, and they had to send him down. But he didn't look over his head when they brought him up. Yeah, a guy who was a college quarterback in the States, you know, two-sport guy, didn't quite know which way he wanted to go, then finally fully committed to baseball, and then he's just had trouble staying healthy. He's had a, you know, horrible string of injuries. But, you know, just I think in the last year they've started to see him, you know, become, you know, learn baseball in the way he has to understand baseball and take the, he's got great athletes. He's like a five-tool guy. So a terrific athlete, but not, you know, there's a difference between being a terrific athlete and being a Major League Baseball player. But I think they started to see him turn the corner, and that's why they rewarded him with the call-up. And again, that's why I think you're going to see him. I think it's, you know, him, Gurriel, Hernandez, those three guys are all right on the cusp of being Major League ball players. You know, I would add Dalton Pompey to that mix too, but he's just been so snake bitten, you know, with health stuff that I don't know, and I don't think they know. But you know, I can guarantee you next spring we're going to be talking about those guys fighting for major league jobs. And you know, remember when Shapiro and Atkins talked about how this team had to get younger and more athletic. You know, that speed had to be more of a factor. That's how you do that. You know, you can't do that through free agency. You do that through developing your own players and having younger players come through your system. So the future of the Jays, you know, the near future, even the 2018 future of the Jays is going to be dictated by players like that. And then they'll go out in the offseason and kind of, you know, try and backfill a bit, try and find another starter, get another couple of bullpen arms. You know, there are going to be aspects of this team that are exactly the same next year. You know, Stroman, Osuna, Sanchez, Tulowitzki and Martin, because they're not going anywhere with those contracts. But I think, you know, almost everybody else in this team, in theory, is in play.
Stephen Brunt joins us on Sportsnet 960, The Fan, Ryan Pinder and Peter Klein.
Not mentioned in the outfield conversation is Jose Bautista, and I think everyone's pretty much assuming that his time with the Blue Jays is up at the end of the year. But with him being placed on revocable waivers, do you see any team coming in a la the Chicago White Sox with Alex Rios a few years ago and making a surprise claim on Bautista this year?
No, I don't. You know, I guess the thing is, you know, first of all, baseball waivers, you know, everybody will be on waivers.
Yeah.
Will be put on revocable waivers in the next month because all that, it does, there's no risk, right? You just, it allows you, once they clear waivers, it allows you to trade guys And, you know, the end of August is the deadline for being part of a major or being part of a playoff roster. So that's the only kind of deadline that's out there now. Otherwise, you can trade guys the last day of the season if you want. So everybody you've ever heard of will be on waivers. They're completely recallable. So if somebody claims them, you can recall them, and then you try and work out a deal. Although in rare instances, you know, you mentioned Rios, they dangled him out there. The White Sox took him. They said, thanks a lot. We'll see you later, because they wanted to unload the salary. But, if you look at Bautista, it's a bad combination, right? He's making, you know, a significant amount of money even between now and the end of the season. He's having a terrible year, like just a terrible year. He looks 1,000 years old. And remember that he was a free agent, available to anyone last winter before this terrible season, and no one was very interested. Plus he's not a good defender in right field at this stage in his career. So, you know, I can't imagine why anyone would take him. I'm sure the Jays would eat a good chunk of the rest of his salary this year just to move him out and have somebody come in, have one of those younger guys play. But I think now they're kind of stuck with the Jose Bautista farewell tour. Which some fans would like that, the fact he's kind of a legacy player and he'll get to play out the season in the uniform. But it is, I just find it really hard to watch him right now. I feel for him. And again, I know people have different feelings about Jose and he's a polarizing guy, but, you know, he's incredibly proud and it must be awful for him to go up there. You know, you just sense the lack of confidence. You know, he's missing pitches that he would have hit 430 feet 2 years ago. It's really tough, and I don't think you get that back at this stage in your career.
Last one from me, because it was out of the headlines for like 35 minutes. Conor McGregor had to say something as Pauly Malignaggi, he didn't drop Pauly Malignaggi. Pauly Malignaggi walked out of McGregor's camp. What did you make of that whole thing?
Well, you know, Pauly Malignaggi, people don't know, a lot of non-boxing people won't know about him. He's a guy who held a couple of world titles, you know, alphabet world titles. And it's a skilled boxer, but a guy who can't punch a lick. You know, he's quick and he's kind of tricky and awkward and a hard guy to hit. So they brought him in to spar with McGregor in preparation for Mayweather. Pauly is also a big talker. You know, does TV commentary now, but he's also a guy who's always, you know, never had trouble working the mic. So they brought him in. There's a lot of talk about it. He said, you know, mostly respectful things about McGregor. They sparred 12 rounds, which is a lot. The first day Malignaggi was in camp after, you know, he said 2 hours after getting off the plane, he was in the ring. And, you know, didn't say anything, you know, disrespectful about McGregor's boxing ability. Talked about how rough he was and stuff like that. But then McGregor's camp released a couple of photos from the sparring, one of which showed Malignaggi on the deck. Now, he said he was pushed, that it was, you know, it wasn't a knockdown. And, you know, he thought that was dirty pool, right? He just said, come on, you can't do that. And he quit the camp and has walked out. So, like, I do think, you know, between now and, you know, the day people have to ante up the $100 for pay-per-view, you're going to hear a lot of stuff that's going to suggest that Conor McGregor is doing amazing things in training, because they need that. You know, they need to kind of build his credibility as a boxer. So this will not be the last time you hear something about him knocking out a sparring partner or something. It's just that, you know, Pauly chose not to play ball with him. You know, he didn't go along with it. And, you know, I assume the next guy they get in there will play ball and say, well, I've never been hit so hard. And, you know, he's doing all these great things. You know, they've got to bridge that credibility gap as best they can. You know, you've already got the crowd that's going to turn out for the circus is going to turn out already. There's obviously, they're going to do really well, but, you know, the skeptics out there, it's that credibility gap between, you know, a guy who is the best boxer of his generation, technically, and a guy who's never boxed professionally in his life. So, again, this is kind of standard stuff. And I said, Pauly just didn't want to follow the script.
Steven, thanks so much for joining us. We do appreciate your visits as always. And if we can set up that brunch date with Boom Boom, that weirdly
would be I will be in the city. Okay. And, yeah, we can, I'll even buy. At the beautiful Rogers Cafeteria.
Wow, how about that? We'll let Jay start that out with you. That's thank you. There's Stephen Brent.